slept in a sleeping bag in the back. By day, he hired himself out to mow lawns and move furniture. Every hour in between, he ran. If he couldn't have Melinda, he'd settle for exhaustion. "I'd get up at 4:30 in the morning, run 20 miles, and it would be a beautiful thing," Micah said. "Then I'd work all day and want to feel that way again. So I'd go home, drink a beer, eat some beans, and run some more." He had no idea if he was fast or slow, talented or terrible, until one summer weekend in 1986 when he drove up to Laramie, Wyoming, to take a stab at the Rocky Mountain Double Marathon. He surprised even himself by winning in 6 hours and 12 minutes, knocking off back-to-back trail marathons in a scratch over 3 hours each. Racing ultras, he discovered, was even tougher than prize fighting. In the ring, the other fighter determines how hard you're hit. But on the trail, your punishment is in your own hands. For a guy looking to beat himself into numbness, extreme running could be an awfully attractive sport. "Maybe I could even go pro if I could just get over these nagging injuries." That thought was running through Micah's mind as he coasted on his bike down a steep boulder street. Next thing he knew, he was blinking into bright lights in the emergency room of Boulder Community Hospital, his eyes caked with blood and his forehead full of stitches. Best he could recall, he'd hit a gravel slick and sailed over the handlebars. "You're lucky you're alive," the doctor told him, which was one way of looking at it. Another was that death was still a problem hanging over his head. Micah had just turned 41, and despite his ultra-running prowess, the view from that ER gurney was none too pretty. He had no health insurance, no home, no close family, and no steady work. He didn't have enough money to stay overnight for observation, and he didn't have a bed to recover on if he checked out. Poor and free was the way he'd chosen to live, but was it the way he wanted to die? A friend let Micah mend on her sofa, and there, for the next few days, he pondered his future. Only lucky rebels go out in a blaze of glory, as Micah knew very well. Ever since second grade, he'd idolized Geronimo, the Apache brave who used to escape the U.S. cavalry by running through the Arizona Badlands on foot. But how did Geronimo end up? As a prisoner, dying drunk in a ditch on a dusty reservation. Once Micah recovered, he headed to Leadville. And there, during a magical night running through the woods with Marti Mano Cervantes, he found his answers. Geronimo couldn't run free forever, but maybe a gringo indio could. A gringo indio who owed nothing, needed no one, and wasn't afraid to disappear from the planet without a trace. "So what do you live on?" I asked. "Sweat," Caballo said. Every summer, he leaves his hut and rides buses back to Boulder, where his ancient pickup truck awaits him behind the house of a friendly farmer. For 2 or 3 months, he resumes the identity of Micah True and scrounges up freelance furniture-moving jobs. As soon as he has enough cash to last another year, he's gone, vanishing down to the bottom of the canyons and stepping back into the sandals of El Caballo Blanco. "When I get too old to work, I'll do what Geronimo would have if they'd left him alone," Caballo said. "I'll walk off into the deep canyons and find a quiet place to lie down." There was no melodrama or self-pity in the way Caballo said this, just the understanding that someday the life he'd chosen would require one last disappearing act. "So maybe I'll see you all again," Caballo concluded, as Tita was killing the lights and shooing us off to bed. "Or maybe I won't." By sunup the next morning, the soldiers of Urique were waiting by the old minibus that was idling outside Tita's restaurant. When Jen arrived, they snapped to attention. "Hasta luego, brujita," they called. Jen blew them screen siren kisses with a big sweep of her arm, then climbed aboard. Barefoot Ted got on next, climbing up gingerly. His feet were so thickly swathed in cloth bandages, they barely fit inside his Japanese bathhouse flip-flops. "They're not bad, really," he insisted, "just a little tender." He squeezed in next to Scott, who willingly slid over to make room. The rest of us filed in and made our sore bodies as comfortable as possible for the jouncing trip ahead. The village tortilla maker, who was also the village barber, shoemaker, and bus driver, slid behind the wheel and revved the rattling engine. Outside, Caballo and Bob Francis walked the length of the bus, pressing their hands against each of our windows. Manuel Luna, Arnulfo, and Silvino stood next to them as the bus pulled out. The rest of the Tarahumara had set off already on the long hike home, but even though these three had the greatest distance to travel, they'd waited around to see us off. For a long time afterward, I could see them standing in the road, waving, until the entire town of Urique disappeared behind us in a cloud of dust. This is Fred Sanders. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Born to Run, A Hidden Tribe, Super Athletes, and the Greatest Race the World Has Ever Seen, by Christopher McDougall. This program was directed by Cassandra Campbell. Executive producers, Orly Moskowitz and Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2009 by Christopher McDougall. Production copyright 2009, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.